So how's your rent these days? Apparently it's still going up, especially in Snohomish County, but there is a task force with a plan, and Kyra's Hannah Scott is here to tell us about it.
And so, Dave, after months of collaboration, Snohomish County's Housing Affordability Regional Task Force, or HART, released a final report yesterday on the housing situation in the county. Bottom line, it's dire and it's getting worse. According to the report, from 2011 to 2019, rent for a two-bedroom apartment in the county doubled to an average of nearly $1,900 a month. Linwood Mayor Nicola Smith.
Snohomish County is tied with King County for the highest housing wage in the state. Someone needs to make almost $76,000 annually to afford a two-bedroom apartment. That equates to $36.52 an hour. Washington State's current minimum wage is $12 per hour, and one would need to work three full-time minimum wage jobs in order to afford a two-bedroom unit.
But she said in the months that this task force was together, they found that this was not just about those minimum wage workers.
In Snohomish County, there are over 95,000 renters. Their estimated hourly wage is $18.60, which is almost $7 more than the minimum wage. But at that income level, the average renter can afford to pay $967 a month without being cost burdened by living expenses. So from minimum wage workers to mechanics to firefighters, teachers, lawyers, there are housing affordability issues across the spectrum.
And all the usual issues are getting the blame that we've heard here in King County, of course, and other areas in the state. Growing population has gutted the housing supply. Median household income for sure has not kept up with the rent increases and home values. And the number of low-income housing units has dropped dramatically from 2011 to 2017. The number of affordable units in the county, those are those that ran out for 800 or less for really low-income people, have dropped by half or two-thirds.
Okay, with rents that high, that should provide an incentive for people to build more apartments. Now,
right.
Are the cities making it easy to build those apartments?
Yeah. So that's my big takeaway here is that so they addressed all the issues, they identified all the issues, and then in this report they came out with this five-year action plan. The action plan is basically, first of all, to do kind of what we did here in King County, get the regional cities all in a conversation together up in Snohomish County to make sure they are all doing that. That what you just said, making it easier for the developers, getting some tax benefits for the developers to make it easier for them to build, getting some new development along specifically transit areas,
yeah,
especially where, you know, ST3 is going to go, all of that. But they want to get everyone on the same page so they're working as a group and not just individual cities, because not everybody does the same thing. One thing that they definitely say they have to address is the issue of density. And to do that, Mayor Smith's message says to NIMBYs, you have to talk to NIMBYs.
It's us, right? For the sake of humanity, when we have this crisis, we have to take care of each other. And we've got to figure out a way to provide shelter.
Now, in Linwood specifically, I don't know if you remember a while back, we talked about an apartment unit that was going to be displaced, right?
And the neighbors just didn't want it replaced.
They didn't want it. It was various issues.
You don't get to do that unless it's a nuisance. Is it throwing off a horrible smell? Is it making a lot of noise? It'll probably generate traffic, but so does everything. So, I mean, you don't get to control somebody else's property unless it's a nuisance.
Well, they fought back because they wanted to change the zoning issue and build it up to six floors, which was not what the current zoning was. They got pushback on that. So that's another thing they want to address. They want to engage the community and deal with the zoning issues and talk to people who push back on this and are worried about their property values or whatever else. Look, this is a problem that's not going away. Another 250,000 people are expected to come to move to Snohomish County in the next 20 years. That puts the population over 1 million. There's not enough housing there now. They have to get everyone in the community on board. They want to talk to big business, churches, see what churches can build, all of that kind of thing. So that's the plan. Nothing that we can expect, though, that's going to fix anything in the next couple of years, and also not a significant plan to deal with any future displacement from those types of situations where people are losing those affordable housing units.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Chris Sullivan, good to have you with us. And Hannah Scott has joined us. And what I want to do, Hannah, is read through the charging papers, which we just got in this shooting 2 weeks ago down by the McDonald's at 3rd and Pine in downtown Seattle, because I think it reveals quite a bit. So, they have a lot of video on this.
Yes.
And it shows two men later identified as William Ray Tolliver and Marquise Littrell. They're both in their 20s. And they've been arrested now. The video shows them standing across from another man identified as Jamel Jackson on the corner of East Pine and 3rd Avenue. Tolliver and Tolbert can be seen exchanging words with Jackson from across the walkway in front of McDonald's. The video shows Tolliver shoots first, firing his handgun at Jackson. Jackson is seen on the video reacting to being shot, and then he is seen taking out his gun and returning fire. Tolbert, this is the third guy, who is standing next to Tolliver, the two of them came together, the two T's came together, then begins firing his gun. Jackson runs away eastbound on East Pine Street. The video shows Tolliver and Tolbert, who had arrived there together a few minutes before the shooting, turn and run southbound on 3rd Avenue, and this is the one that gets me. They turn and run southbound on 3rd Avenue, shooting indiscriminately behind them as they run and continuing to shoot even after Jackson was out of sight on East Pine Street, which is unbelievable to me. So they decide to start this argument in the center of downtown Seattle, one of the most crowded areas, and then one of them runs down the street, shooting behind him, probably not even looking.
Yep, and both of them, according to these charging documents, are identified, the three men, I should say, are members of rival gang members, the Deuce Eights and the Hoovers, and apparently, according to the charging documents, there was some words exchanged, and then Tolliver, I believe, like you said, shot first. The other guy was running away. He was gone, out of sight, and then, as you said, they were firing behind him. No regard for the innocent lives, right. The very many innocent lives around them whatsoever. Absolutely terrifying.
They find 19 shell casings. One of the victims, as we know now, Tanya Jackson, no relation to the guy involved in the argument, died from gunshot wounds she suffered. She was shot once, standing on 3rd Avenue south of McDonald's. But here are the other victims. They just use initials. CM, a woman in a wheelchair, shot three times in the same location. D.O., shot once as he was standing outside the Money Tree, which is located just south of McDonald's. J.C., 9-year-old child, standing on the corner with his family, shot once in the thigh.
And other children were near with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so here's what I'm getting to. One of these guys got help from his girlfriend, Tolbert's girlfriend. Her first name is Adasho Shara. Drives them to Las Vegas in her car. Then rents him a hotel room in Las Vegas under an alias. They have video surveillance of all this, so they know who they are. So far, only the three men have been charged. She has not been charged. That's a chargeable offense, right?
Absolutely, and I would expect she would be charged.
Okay, so we hope that's coming.
Or they may try to get some sort of evidence, it's gang life. Get her to talk or something to that.
Okay, here's what they find in the vehicle. A receipt from a gun store in South King County was found in the car. The receipt is dated January 22nd and shows a transaction from 12:30 p.m., approximately 4.5 hours before the shooting takes place on the same day. The receipt shows a cash sale for a Glock 380 caliber 12-round magazine, which holds double the ammunition of the stock magazine. Detectives obtained a video from the store that captured the sale. Tolbert is seen on the gun store video buying the 380 caliber magazine, wearing the same clothing he's wearing in the video that captures the shooting. The sales staff member at the gun store told detectives Tolbert specifically wanted the extended clip. This was not a legal sale, right? Or was it? He could not have bought a gun, but all these guys were felons. They had felonies on their record. He would not have been legally entitled to buy a gun. Was he legally entitled to buy a clip?
There's nothing, I don't believe, in our state that says you cannot buy ammunition when you're illegal.
Well, then there you go.
Banned from firearms. But that's why there's the bill right now in Olympia that would make that illegal and then would also require the background checks on ammo sales. The problem is that's something that the FBI, the federal background check system, has to get to a place where it does those kind of background checks on ammo sales before any state can actually do that.
What does the FBI have to do? It's a computer thing, right?
It's their system would have to be the system that is used to run a background check on ammunition.
Okay. It's a database. We have databases everywhere. I can get data on you, on me, on everybody in this. I can get data about anybody in America in like 10 seconds on Google. So you're telling me this is there's some kind of technical impediment here to getting this done? Is there any reason that this guy should have been sold a clip? Do you think the guy in that gun store wanted to sell the clip that might have ended up killing this woman? I don't think
Absolutely not. But what's the alternative? If you're not going to go through the very complicated and complex background check system, should that even become law that you do background checks on ammo, then...
What's complicated? This guy has to present some kind of ID to buy the clip?
It's not the law. That's just not the law of the land right now.
That should be the law. And also, the felony is in a computer somewhere. That can be put in a database. So the guy hands over his ID. We tap it in and says, oh, looks like you have a felony. I'm going to call the cops now. So
there's so many issues with that.
Why can't that be done?
A variety of reasons. One, it's a lot to ask of the gun retailer, to the firearms dealer, mm-hmm. to look up Google or look up into a criminal record system whether somebody has a felony and whether those records are accurate. You can count on them being accurate when you're going through the background check systems. I don't think you have that certainty when you're just going through a website, a background search thing
really?
That you find
so
online.
That's it. I can check out a book by sticking my ID under a little reader, and in half a second, they know who I am and they know I've got the book. We can't do that at gun shops when not doing it could lead to something like this, a shootout in downtown Seattle during rush hour that kills a person?
It's an interesting question. I don't think you can do that. I imagine there are multiple legal barriers, but also there are a lot of people who don't support any kind of background check on ammo sales. But certainly, I don't think anybody would say they wanted to sell this to the person who was behind
a
mass
shooting. Don't you think the guys at the gun shop would have appreciated the help?
Yeah.
Rather than knowing he's sold? Well, okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Hannah.
Anyways, these guys are in Vegas coming back hopefully for arraignment on the 19th. We'll see.
That'll be good.
Well, how about a daily dose of kindness?
Sounds good.
It's a little short one, but it's local. I always like to share local doses of kindness. So reach out to me if something has happened in your life or if you know of somebody who's being kind in your neighborhood. I'll share their story, too. This one out of GhostGadget.com. The city of Anacortes Council just voted to accept a big donation, but they'll never know who it came from, only where it will go. The Anacortes Senior Activity Center. It has a bad roof on rainy days like today. As you can imagine, there are leaks dripping in the hallway, garbage cans placed under the leaks to catch the water. Staff members have to place safety cones where the water is dripping just to be safe. It's not like the city hasn't tried to get the senior center a new roof. GhostGadget.com reports there were bids to do the work back in spring of last year, but both bids exceeded the budget. And then two companies who were awarded contracts eventually defaulted on those contracts. Then out of nowhere, an anonymous donor sent a check of $150,000 to get the job done. City officials say they've never seen anything like it. They see donations to the library, the parks department all the time. But to get so much towards a senior activity center, well, they say that's tremendous.
That is a great thing. And a lot of problems could be solved by people who've got money they don't know what to do with, just sort of slipping it into the right hands.
It'd be nice if I could do that. By the way, your daily dose of kindness is sponsored by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com, and we appreciate that.
Now joining us from the Gene Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon on Cairo Radio, Gene Scott. Did you read those charging papers from the thing 2 weeks ago?
I really did.
See, I read through it. I've already gotten pushback from it, but the... one of the gunmen, 4.5 hours before the shooting, went to a gun shop in South Seattle and bought an extended magazine. And it was pointed out to me, well, you know, magazine is not ammo. Well, you can't shoot the ammo without the magazine. So why are we selling a magazine to somebody who's a felon?
I mean, the assumption is that magazine is not going to go for a birthday cake, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to go to a gun. And it's unfortunate. I think that there are something in place that in the future that can be prevented. You know, Dave, this is a very tragic and unfortunate thing, the whole Third and Pine incident. But there are a lot of Third and Pine incidents all over the United States, and the question is how can we prevent that from happening again? When you look at those charging papers, you see that all three of them had been going to jail. One of them was a felon.
Two had felonies. The other guy had a conviction for possessing a firearm illegally.
None of them were supposed to have guns.
Right.
And then, you know, you have all different sides, right? Like, hey, we need to have more gun laws to make sure that they don't have these guns. Okay, you could be right. And hey, we need to lock up more people and keep them arrested. You could be right. But the problem, Dave, is, Colleen, we need to make sure we get this from the beginning. And what ends up happening is One of those guys, their parents were locked away. And then it's just...
Well, we know. His mom, he, according to what he said, has a drug problem.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't believe her son did it. But we're not going to be able to re-engineer that family. To me, let me ask you this. Would it be okay, since these guys are known felons, and the cops knew them. They had known them for a long time.
Sure.
Why can't they, you know, maybe, I don't know, once a week or so, knock on the door and got any guns? Got any magazines there? Got any bullets we should know about?
I don't think.
Or would that be harassment?
I don't think there's enough manpower to do that. I don't think
That's what the gang unit's there for, aren't they?
There's a lot of gangs, Dave. There's a lot of people. You know what I mean?
Would hire more. All right, let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. Should we hire more so there are enough to make those checks?
Absolutely.
All right, then.
Yes, we've been.
So you're not against it?
No, I'm not against that at all. What was the situation that happened at the Target maybe last year in 2019 where there was some robbery going on at the Target? It took a long time for the police to get to the Target up north and everything because we have a shortage of police officers. We have a shortage of law enforcement, and I think that there should be more law enforcement to get to the bottom of these things. This is a very unfortunate thing, but it's happened now, and so what can be done? And out arresting everyone and locking everyone up, is it the answer? Because if that was the answer, then the guys that did this, who've been arrested so many times, they would have probably been fixed. And there needs to be more happening before
the rehabilitation.
Absolutely.
Or at least to show them a way out of gangs. I wonder, too, if enough emphasis for the Seattle Police Department or King County Sheriff, whatever, it may be even Pierce County, even Snohomish County, just region-wide, if there's enough emphasis on gang rehabilitation, gang exit. I have grown up here my entire life. And maybe it's just my lived experience. I don't associate the Seattle Pacific Northwest with heavy gang activity. Do I know gangs are around? Absolutely. But I don't associate it with, say, New York City. I see that as a city with more gang and crime problems. So is there enough emphasis on meeting those gangs where they're at and showing them a way out here in Seattle? Are we being too lazy about that around here?
I think it's the before. I think that
that's what I'm saying, That's what I'm saying, too.
I think right now there is a 9-year-old right now.
Yeah.
That is somewhere.
Who wants
to feel like they belong.
And they join a gang of brotherhood.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's what ends up happening. So we need to put more funding into those programs.
We're arguing the same thing.
Yeah. No, I'm not arguing. We're
advocating for the same thing,
too.
That's what I'm saying. I want to know, what are the numbers of the SPD gang unit? What are the numbers of the King County Sheriff gang unit? I don't think it's enough. I think we have a gang problem, and we're not willing to admit it. Because what we're doing is we're calling this downtown shooting a mass shooting. It is not. It is deadly gang violence is what it is. You have to call it what it is to solve it.
I know we all don't want it to happen again.
That's for sure. G. Scott joins Ursula for G and Ursula at 9 o'clock on Cairo Radio. What will the state's next big transportation package look like? A state senator is out with a new plan that could mean a carbon fee or some kind of cap-and-trade program, and that would mean higher gas prices. Hannah is here to tell us how real that is.
So this is last legislative session. We talked about Senate Transportation Chair Steve Hobbs had started to have discussions about what our new transportation package could look like. Right. It always takes a while to get one of these done. He had at that time, it was a 10-year, $16.3 billion idea. He took a bunch of public comment. Now, this week, he came out with kind of a revised version. This version is now a 15-year plan that would bring in the equivalent of another 5 years on top of the 16.3, so a little under $30 billion. And he's got three options that he's floating around now, two different carbon options. But to start this all off, remember that the governor has the low carbon fuel standard that he is pushing. So even last year, there was pushback between the two of them on which one of these things we wanted to get done. Senator Hobbs made a plea for people not to essentially pick on him for putting these options out there at the start of this committee hearing yesterday.
We need to have a grown-up conversation about carbon policy because there's a lot of carbon policies out there. And I know it's been reported in the press that, you know, I've been pressured to accept certain carbon bills out here. The problem is all those threaten the transportation budget. And I'm already constrained. I have to deal with 976 currently, and gas tax revenues are declining. So how am I going to meet all those transportation needs?
And then also he has to meet the expanding multimodal system needs and dealing with the court-ordered fish culverts fix.
We just have to figure out a new way to fund our transportation. I don't think we should put our heads in the sand over this particular bill. And it doesn't help when you have some people who say that, you know, you're no better than a climate denier by offering something different.
So there's a lot of background.
So that's what's going on.
Yeah.
The idea here is you got to raise money to maintain and build the roads. We're not going to go without roads. So who should we root for here?
Someone to get some kind of a transportation package together at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure, you know, if the carbon tax is the way to go with things at all. I'm really not a big fan of those. However, there is one thing in Hobbs's plan that I think makes a lot of sense, at least at the local level. He's got the, you know, if you build a development,
mm-hmm.
You got to put in some darn money for the infrastructure.
Sure.
So
we had that rule.
No, it. You can. There are so many ways to get around that rule and exemptions that you can build a brand new high school and not widen the road in front of it. It's happened in my neighborhood. We built a brand new 4A high school, and 35th Avenue in Snohomish still is only two lanes wide, but they weren't required to do it because they got through some sort of loophole. Yeah. So there's an assessed value assessment that you would, what was it, 4% for commercial, 0.4%, sorry, for commercial. I mean, I think that's a no-brainer, that if you build something, you've got to put something in for your impact, and we got to find a way to emphasize that. I think that was something you put on the front end before you start thinking about carbon taxes, because that's something you can do right now, and I think a lot of people, now certainly developers wouldn't be happy about that, but that would certainly help with some of the places that you're seeing that are maybe outside, unincorporated Snohomish County, unincorporated Kitsap, unincorporated Whatcom, you name it. I think that would go a long way, and I don't see there being as much of a fight over that. Everyone's kind of caught up in his cap and trade and his carbon tax and all that stuff, but this seems something reasonable that we could get on, but you know, I don't know if we'll get there.
And he had, so yesterday was just a stream of the various jurisdictions coming, talking about what projects are important to them. And none of them really wanted to commit to one of the three proposals. He's got two different carbon fee proposals and then a cap and trade proposal. All three of them include a gas tax hike that would be between 6 and 8 cents, depending on which option ended up passing. Again, this is discussion. It's going does it pass this session?
Well, it seems to me there's a deal to be made there. There are a lot of people who just, you can see it coming. They don't want this use fee. They don't want their driving to be tracked. They hate that. And yet you have to fix the roads. So why not keep it simple and just raise the gas tax? The climate people would like that because it discourages gasoline use. It doesn't track you or anything. Yes, your gas is more expensive, but I remember when gas was close to $4. It's nowhere near that now. So any gas tax they impose is not going to put us anywhere near what gas was in the bad old days when it was going directly to Saudi Arabia, for crying out loud.
But the problem with that is that they're moving away and going towards the road usage charge. So, I mean, raise the gas tax.
More people have electric vehicles and hybrids.
Yeah, but the electric vehicles are not really the problem here, right, if we're talking about climate. So that would satisfy
those
people.
But they are for wear and tear on the roads.
Right.
So they do have their share.
And you don't pay the gas tax.
You're not going to get everything you want, though, right? And nobody wants to be tracked. It's going to be expensive.
Oh, yeah.
So we know how we already know how to impose a gas tax. There's no more record-keeping requirements involved. So you pay a little bit more, much less than you were 2 years ago still, and you get your roads. Huh?
But you don't. As everything switches over with such a big push to electric vehicles, you won't get that gas tax income. That's the problem.
The one thing we can agree on, Senator Hobbs, we do need an adult discussion about this.
Yes.
It's time to start talking real in this stuff and stop fluffing around with it. Let's just get to work.
And quickly, a lot of senators weren't at their Transportation Committee hearing yesterday. There's a lot of heated background battle going on because of these conversations. So we'll keep an eye on it through the rest of the session.
Thank you, Hannah. Choke points.
Let's go.
Well, look at this. That passenger-only ferry to Kitsap County has proved to be really, really popular. So they're adding more boats. I would think, though, in a free market, you just raise the fares and then you could, you know, pay for more boats.
Well, you know, the thing is they're a fledgling operation, Kitsap Transit, in terms of adding a ferry system or a ferry fleet. So they've been buying what they can, and they've actually gotten a couple of new boats that they're about to put into service and whatnot. So it's actually proven to be a pretty good deal for in terms of the people looking for options to get across the water. And right now, the Bremerton to Seattle run, which is where they started, that was the first run that they did. You can make it across the water in 30 minutes. Again, passenger only. A second boat is going to be added to that service on Monday, the 24th.
We've essentially doubled the capacity, not to mention improving the convenience to where now we'll
basically have a vessel leaving either side once every 30 minutes instead of basically once an hour.
That's Kitsap Transit Executive Director John Clausen, who says the testing late last year that they did to make sure they weren't going to add any environmental impact to Rich Passage came back and showed that they didn't really do any extra damage to the shorelines there with an extra boat, so they're going forward with it. Now, riders will notice a change with this new service. Reservations are not going to be required on this second boat.
If we find later on that it is something that we believe we're going to have to turn on, we can easily turn the reservation system on for those additional sailings. But to begin with, we're going to operate those new trips without reservations and see how it goes.
And Clausen appears to have been right on when determining the demand for this. More than 300,000 riders used that ferry on the Bremerton-Seattle run last year. Monthly sailings up 7% over 2018.
We certainly did anticipate that we would have good ridership, but it has been growing quicker than we anticipated.
And while the Bremerton-Seattle run gets most of the attention, the fast ferry running between Kingston and Seattle is almost as popular. It's been running for just over a year, had 175,000 passengers last year. That gets you from Kingston to downtown Seattle in 35 minutes. There's no other way to get there that fast, I guess, maybe to fly your own jetpack. And the route to Southworth to Seattle is going to start later this year. That means there are going to be 5 boats running on 3 routes.
We're looking forward to bringing those into the fleet, and certainly makes it much easier for us to be able to provide that reliable service when you have spares.
But with this growth comes a little problem with spacing. Seattle's new passenger-only ferry service or dock that opened late last year was designed before Kitsap Transit was even a thing. And so they weren't expecting 5 boats to be competing for what was supposed to be a 2-boat dock.
That's where our big choke point is. We have a dock that we're sharing with King County that is designed for 2 boats at any one time. And at that point, we will have 5 routes that will be coming into downtown Seattle.
And here's a question I get a lot from people who drive over from Gig Harbor, drive over from Bremerton, or catch a state ferry right now. Is it viable to live and maybe move to Kitsap County and still work in downtown Seattle? Because you obviously get more home for your buck over there. The housing market, which I'll get to in a moment, is pretty good compared to some of the other places. And I think this passenger-only service, if you work in downtown, is making that option kind of viable for some people if it works just for them, because you've got more options to get over here fast. So you can take a bus from your home down to the dock, take a passenger-only ferry over, catch your bus to wherever you are in downtown Seattle. It seems to work pretty well, but you better get while the getting's good, because Zillow lists the market over there as like red hot. Mm-hmm. Average home price is getting close to $400,000 in Kitsap County.
Yeah, but here it's what? Six, seven,
right, yeah. Exactly. In Snohomish County, it's getting towards 5. You know, so we're looking at things like that. So it may not be a bad option for you, but the service is definitely there.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.